The indie farming hit Stardew Valley, where stylish pixel graphics will hook you as you build your perfect farm, is just one of the excellent titles available to play now on Apple Arcade. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
And so we spent a lot of time like just being like, is it scary, do we need to add something scarier here? Are we hitting like all the fears that people have in their life? I don't know if we are, but
we didn't do arachnophobia. We could have done that one harder.
Yeah, right. We're trying really hard to do that. I mean, that was really the challenge, is like, are we hitting that bar?
sifter.com.au.
Hello and welcome to Lightmap from Sifter, our video game industry interview show. I'm Gianni De Giovanni. The team at Yacht Club Games are masters at modernizing nostalgia, and this week are launching their Game Boy inspired The Hollower, mining directly from my childhood. But before we jump into that, here is what has been making the news on Walkthrough, which is Sifter's news podcast.
Hi, I'm Mitch Lowe.
And I'm Gianni De Giovanni.
And here are the top stories this week on Walkthrough, Sifter's weekly news podcast for Sunday, the 7th of June.
It's Summer Games Fest with stacks of new announcements and, Jeff's favourite, heaps and heaps of puppets.
God of War Levee and so many other great-sounding games got some release dates and new trailers in the state of play.
The Steam Machine and Steam Frame are actually maybe possibly finally shipping in the next couple of months.
Plus, we give you a preview of the most interesting games that are releasing this week.
You can get every episode of Walkthrough for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or on our website, sifter.com.au, every Sunday.
Join the Sifter community on Discord at sifter.com.au/Discord.
Cast your mind back to your favorite games growing up. For a lot of people, when you ask them what their favorite Zelda game is, they're going to say Ocarina of Time. It's incredibly good, but I'm going to admit something to you right now. I've actually never finished it. I had a PlayStation as a kid, so I have no nostalgia for that. But what I do have a lot of nostalgia for is the Game Boy era Zelda games. They captured my heart. I ran around Koholint Island, first on monochromatic green screen, then in color a few years later. So when I saw that the Shovel Knight developers, Yacht Club Games, were putting their hat into the ring for a top-down 2D adventure game with Mina the Hollower, I was hooked. David D'Angelo is a programmer on the game. Nick Wozniak is an artmancer or pixel artist on the game Mina the Hollower. Welcome to Lightmap to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, excited to talk.
Am I on the mark here? Are we thinking about those 2D Zelda games and those NES era games and all of those sort of stuff with the heart of what Mina the Hollower is?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we wear that on our sleeves pretty well, or pretty strongly, especially in terms of like the art style and the we sourced a lot of existing Game Boy Color screenshots to like kind of develop the palette, and that helped us like help drive the visuals. And so that was sort of the, like, you know, going back to just like old games like that was our guiding light visually.
And yeah, so I guess, can you tell me, looking at those sort of things, and you've worked, with Shovel Knight for Yonks, and, you have this idea, and much of nostalgia, I think, is often filtered through our memories of what these things are rather than what they actually are. And I'm really curious about sort of your design considerations about making something that feels like a game you would have played as a child, but is much more modern, uses all of the design and gameplay considerations that we'd expect from something coming out in 2026.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots to kind of break down, like what you actually liked from stuff as a kid and like what you remember, and that the delta of like what actually was and like what you enjoy is interesting always, like to go back and actually try those games and see what they were like. But I think what we did with Shovel Knight and kind of what we did here is to make sure that like what we are doing is not trying to mimic something as much as like bring those things that we did like into the modern age as much as, you know, in the same structure. You know, we were talking about, David, this morning we're talking about like lives and stuff, right? With the sparks.
Something like the spark system in Mina is, we like really wanted to do lives in video games. Like, you know, 6 years back when we started this project, everyone was saying, oh, they should get rid of lives in Mario's. It's such an antiquated idea. You could never, you know, it's just come from arcades. Everyone, like, that's so stupid. It's just like, just suck your quarters. And, you know, we're looking at this stuff going, like, there's valuable ideas and lives, like, that haven't been explored or, that, you know, there's a purpose to them doing that that still makes sense today and that we could integrate that in a cool way. So in Mina, for example, there's, like, a system where if you die, you know, we want a consequence. So if you die, you lose your the bones, the sidearm or the subweapon you've been carrying. But you have a chance to get it back. You have like an extra life essentially, and you can upgrade and get multiple extra lives and we played around with that system too. So like that life, if you die, the enemy like holds onto that life and you can kill them and get it back. And then you never lose your bones, you know, or you can level up and get all those lives back the same way you might level up in an old game and get all your health and, you know, all these benefits. So, you know, we're like looking at those old games for inspiration about how to do it. And I would say the like technical restrictions we're putting around it are more about like nodding to the fact that like what to expect out of this game. Like you're gonna expect something with, you know, the same kind of gameplay you might see in an old title. You know, we're more than we're like slavishly devoted to making it seem like a Game Boy color game, right? There's no sprite flickering or like there's too many sprites on screen, it better slow down right now.
Yeah, we're also like not like just taking stuff from the past just because, right? Like one of the things that came up a lot during, at least during like the design phase, was like we're not going to have an inventory. Like you don't have a thing that you're holding, and like there's, because like, you know, in Link's Awakening, there's that whole side quest where you like you find the leaf and then you get like the Yoshi doll and then like it's the Bow Wow bow, and it's like that kept coming up because of like how, you know, we're referencing Link's to the past in our brains a lot, but we wanted to like really look at that and say like, you know, it's just because it was done in the past doesn't mean it has inherent value. And so like we strongly like figured out a way to do weird quests or whatever with more physical interactions and stuff like that. So this is another example besides just the lives of like not being held to the past.
Yeah. And I think what's fun about that Game Boy era is like you said, Ocarina of Time was like a big thing. Game Boy was like still happening then, right? It's like crazy to think about that. And in that era, a lot of the developers, like if you look at something like Pokemon is a huge game, right? With, I mean, like 100 plus monsters that you can collect, which is like insane, even by like a PlayStation standards, like, you know, games weren't doing that. But because that was like the flavor of the time was like, how big can we make our games, right? It was interesting to have that mixed with the restrictions of a Game Boy, right? So like, I mean, that's a lot of what we're getting out of Mina too, is like we're making this like huge intricate complex thing, but with the restrictions of like this is a small, it's like on a tiny screen, it's a tiny resolution, it's got a limited colors, it has these restrictions that like it makes this interesting flavor of like the big and the small combined.
Yeah, I love that. I'm curious as well, I guess, how do you hold those things back? Like, where do you sort of draw the line saying, okay, we could potentially, you know, get rid of some of those things? You said like, yeah, too many sprites on a screen slows the game down, but would that be an interesting thing to include in it for like a particular gameplay reason? Like, do you have those sort of conversations about what's in, what's out, when you're trying to make it feel like the things we remember?
Right. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, if you're playing Space Invaders. It's interesting in Space Invaders when it slows down, right? To make it like easier right. or harder.
Or speeds up, right? Yeah.
But yeah, generally it is like, we're taking things on a case by case basis. And I would say overall, we're coming up with like a rule set of like, here's what makes sense on Mina. So it's not necessarily that like slow down is a bad idea, but it's like, well, like, can we, like, if we're going to do it, does it make sense? And if it doesn't, if we can't think of a reason to make sense, let's like, we're going to say that's like off the table for this game. You know, we're going to put more sprites on the screen than a Game Boy could allow because we want to have bosses that, you know, have these kind of options. It's like that kind of stuff. And we're going, you know, like, but in like Shovel Knight, for example, we were like, we're not going to put too many sprites on the screen. We're going to like really focus on that. Like if a boss has, if they're shooting six things out of them, it's like, that's too many things. and so it's like that. It's like finding the, just like the balance of how each element goes in there and like where it makes sense.
I'm really curious about, I guess, the way that you're sort of pitching the game out to audiences, like these games are the ones that I grew up on, you know, but these need to sit amongst, you know, the canon of everything that's coming out, like a Saros or whatever in the space. And like, what do you think about the type of players who are interested in these games?
Well, there's definitely probably a lot of overlap of people our age playing the kind of games that we like, just because like we all grew up in the same generation. So I think there's going to be definitely a lot of like people that look like us, you know, playing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what we're doing too is like we're trying to bring attention to those games.
Yeah.
So I think it might be hard for someone that is 18 years old to look at our game and go, that looks cool, because they have like no reference point for it, right? But we're, you know, by signaling it's cool to someone that's our age, that might like bring, you know, they're saying, oh, it's just as cool as Saros, right? and then that will get the 18-year-old excited, right? And then the 18-year-old will play it and they'll go like, now I'm interested in like what Link's Awakening was, or what Final Fantasy Adventure was, or what, you know, the original Pokemon was like, or, you know, name your favorite like games from the era that like might mix, you know, that are weirdo titles. But like that's part of it. It's like we're trying to like get people interested in those kind of things again, and I think the way we are like modernizing the gameplay is that's what makes it like comfortable for those people and appealing to those people when they see, oh, they have like a really cool inventive idea here. Like they probably don't know it's inventive, right? Because they don't have like a history of games to know what's inventive or not. But like other people are saying this is like a cool idea, or we put in a really stupid joke that like appeals to everyone, obviously. And when they see in the trailer like a guy with like a 40-foot long nose, they'll be like, oh, that's like really stupid, and I want to play that.
Yeah, that's, I love that. What I'm really curious about as well is, you know, when you've got, you know, games like this, and I was thinking a bit about what you were talking about with the Lives, for example, right? Where, you know, like everyone had a game that their auntie or their grandmother gave them that wasn't very, very good, but you only had about three games. And so sometimes I feel like the like, you know, the ramp of challenge was much higher because like, I've got nothing else to play. And I'm wondering what you think about that in the context of like basically infinite choice as well.
Yeah, man, I think about that all the time. Cause like I definitely had, you know, eight games on my NES, and I just like played the crap out of them. Even like I can remember playing games before I could read or not read well and like not understanding what was going on in terms of like a story or whatever, but just like liking the part and trying to interact with it and like trying to understand what was going on without really comprehending it. But just like keep pushing. And then I contrast that to like my kids who just have eight infinite supply of video games, and like they, I don't know, it's sort of like, it's really similar to when you download a 400 pack of ROMs, you know, on your emulator. I would never do this, but on your emulator.
No, but people do. We've heard they've done that. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard. Yeah. And it's just like you're just frozen with choice, and you try each game for like 2 seconds, and then you move on.
You try the A games, and you try the Z
games. Yeah, or you go to the Z game, like, oh, Zool, cool. Let's try Zool. ironically, that was Zool on the Game Gear, was one of those games that I had, like, of my 10 games, you know. But anyway, yeah, I think it's like it's hard to like to except when you do that, like when you have a game that you really just like pour time into and really understand, you start to see past the like jankiness, and you can find the little gems of value that it has, like we were talking about, like, yeah, like it's really hard to play because you don't understand what the logic is, but it's cool when you accomplish something in that game. You know, it's really hard to understand what you're supposed to be doing in the Star Trek Game Gear game. This is another Game Gear game. But once you understand what you're supposed to be doing and like what they're trying to make you do, it's like it's cool to have a spaceship battle on like a tiny little handheld. I don't know. I think like it's cool to be part of the conversation of like, hey, this is what's valuable and this is like what we like from this generation. And like, you know, even if you're a Minecraft kid who's never played anything but a 3D game, like here's something maybe you can try out, you know, like, you know, it'll be okay. It's just 2D.
I think one of the benefits of like what we're doing with Mina is that it is an RPG, like maybe a light RPG, but like even if you suck at games, if you put enough time into it, you will level up, you will like be able to buy more equipment, you'll be able to like find ways to proceed that's like a fun way that we can like I think maybe engage with people that like haven't had difficult games. But that said, with all the millions of games coming out these days, like there are really hard games, and you know, there all the Souls games and Souls likes, you know, all the roguelikes that are coming out, I feel like it's maybe more than ever like a good time to have a difficult game, which is sort of bizarre to think about given like I don't know, like 10 years ago it's like if you made a hard game like people hated you.
Yeah, if people are up for the punishment now, they just need something to defeat. I'm curious. Okay, so let's talk about Mina more generally, and I'm just interested about like what is it that this game does and what are you trying to achieve, like, you know, as a studio, as a team that's working on this, like what were you setting out to do, and now that people are kind of getting their hands on it, what are you starting to see coming through?
I mean, in general, I think we were trying to make something that was like the Zelda to our Mario. Like if Shovel Knight was our Mario, this would be our Zelda. And we didn't really want to make a very puzzly game, but we did want to have that kind of like, we like the action feel of Zelda and like the mystery of it and like feeling like you're in a world and everything's like everything connects and all these people live here. And we like the like the building of your character and like the way you're making them like oh, I play with the hook shot and someone else might not play with the hook shot, right? I'm a boomerang guy. We like that kind of like that part of it, but we wanted to like, and we like the like, how do I get to this area? How do I unlock this? How do I do this? But we are trying more to like avoid like, I use a boomerang and I bounce it off the mirror and that's how I get past this part. So it was way more like an action focused with just like a tint of that like mystery stuff. And you know, when we were doing that, we were looking at things like Bloodborne and Souls games because they have like to us, like when I played Darks or Demon Souls for the first time, I was like, oh my god, they made Zelda 2 in 3D. This is amazing. Which I don't think anyone else in the world was thinking. No. It's just like my weird brain. But that's like, to us, that is like, they aren't so far apart, like a Zelda game and a Souls game. And it's like, how do we, like, it's like one, I would say like Souls is a version of like, you're inspired by those like old Zelda games. And I guess we were trying to do like another version of that.
Yeah, I think another, like you touched on it a little bit, but like the just like creating a world that you can kind of like live in and spread your wings through a little bit. Like with Shovel Knight coming out of there, that's a I mean, Shovel Knight's a 2D platformer. And so there's only so much of the world that you can really feel like you're living in. You know, and we try to do that with the backgrounds and make it so that you are seeing a vista into the mountains or whatever. But it, ultimately, it still feels like you are like you're going through a location that has been painted on. Like it's obvious where the collision is. It feels like, you know, a location that like is a it's first a gameplay arena, and then it has like the veneer of a castle or a swamp or whatever. And I think one of the cool ways things about this game for me at least was like you can really feel that this is more of a real world, if that makes sense. And every time you enter a new room, it's like it feels more like a location rather than just like a obstacle course that's painted like a castle.
Yeah, I mean, along those lines, we did like medieval stuff in Shovel Knight, right? So we were thinking like, oh, what could we base this around? And we went with like Victorian. And when we were like looking at that stuff, we were thinking a lot like more about like novels like Frankenstein and Dracula, like the things that inspired Castlevania or other like creepy, scary stuff. And I think creating like a world, like Shovel Knight is very like cheery. And I mean, it has like elements of like sadness, like the campfires and Shield Knight like falling in the dream sequence. But it's like for the most part, it's like goofy, silly stuff. And we are trying to think of something that's more like, oh, like maybe it's not all happy, you know? Maybe it's like Frankenstein, where the entire time he's like thinking about the horror that he unleashed upon the world, right? And maybe the world has a feeling like, I guess to us, like dumb Americans, like Victorian London time feels like another fantasy world, like imaginative place.
Definitely does.
Yes. So it's like, oh, if we're like seeped in that kind of like feeling that you have when you're reading those books, it will feel like another world, which, you know, maybe when someone in British person plays it, they'll be like, this is just normal.
that's just me walking down Fleet Street, isn't it?
You know? Right.
Six is just my house. Yeah. That's exactly. So funny.
I mean, it's curious as well. I'm interested as well, because obviously, you know, the jokes and the fun and all that sort of stuff is just like a mainstream of all the things that you guys do. But you know, like making it a slightly darker, a bit more ambiguous, like, does this feel like a level up? Like you've grown up as a studio when you're putting these things together, because you're now into, I guess, your next big series.
It's hard to say that we've ever grown up.
Yeah, it's hard. That's to like weird. It's hard to pull ourselves out of the goofiness, and like it does still kind of feel like a Muppet Presents a Victorian horror.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, constantly over the development of this game, we're going, is this scary, is this like, right? I mean, we knew we were making like something like Castlevania scary, which is still like for kids, right? It's not like a horror, I'm freaked out, oh my god game. But we were trying to make something that's like, maybe you would get scared. Maybe there are moments where you're like sweating or you're nervous or you think about it the next day because it was sort of frightening. And in that way, but I guess our, like, we were doing that, but our tendency is always to add dumb stuff to it.
It's so hard.
And
we're
and
so dumb.
When we're adding and when we're adding scary stuff, we're just like, I guess we didn't really know how to make it scary, right? Or like when you're working on something as a team, you're like, you're putting in something that you think is scary, but like the difference between something being scary and funny is like not that, it's like very tiny, right?
Yeah, and we're not like, none of us are like really strong, I don't know, I don't want to speak for everybody, but like really strong horror fans. I think the horror movie that we all like have in common is like Gremlins 2, which is like, there's scary stuff, but it's there, you're there for fun, and it's like goofy, and like that's what appeals to us the most. No one, I don't think anyone at the company is really like a slasher buff, you know, like my favorite movie is Hellraiser. Like it's like, It's Gremlins 2. It's Muppet Christmas Carol is like like it's those kind of goofy, like it's dark, but like we like having like the fun of it is really hard for us to avoid.
Like there's some spooky stuff. There's some spooky stuff in Ghostbusters, for example, but like it's
Totally.
It's very Ghostbusters, And so we spent a lot of time like just being like, is this scary? Is this scary? Do we need to add something scarier here? Are we hitting like all the fears that people have in their life? I don't know if we are, but
we didn't do arachnophobia. We could have done that one harder.
Yeah, right. We're trying really hard to do that. I mean, that was really the challenge, is like, are we hitting that bar?
I'm really interested as well, you know, in terms of one of the things I really love is going through and having a look to see the adjustments and the ways that people can tune the way that they play the game. And there is just like stacks, heaps to choose from. And I really feel like you can really make your own experience with these sorts of things. And from a design consideration, what do you think about those sort of things in terms of like someone having, the core experience of what you intend versus adjusting it to the way that they want to play? Because like you could pretty much make yourself nearly invincible if you wanted to effectively.
Literally, you can, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm curious about how you talk about that as a studio.
Yeah, I'd always wanted to do those. Those came from the Shovel Knight cheat codes that we had done before, of just like having lots of fun modifiers. And they had been buried behind backer exclusive rewards. You know, one of the backer rewards in Shovel Knight Kickstarter was a code that only you got. And so this is like us exposing that to everybody so that everybody could have fun with that in the same way. But like those modifiers weren't on our mind when crafting the core experience. Those were like something we really were excited about and wanted to add later and knew we were going to add, but like, you know, we spent a lot of our time focusing and really honing that like unmodified experience and that presenting that as like the true Mina balanced, you know, the experience.
Yeah. And I would say like for us too, it's like, it wasn't really as much about difficulty adjusting or like having an easy mode as much as it was like this. It's fun to turn on stuff like that. It's fun to be like invincible and go through the game. We grew up on like Game Genie and like arcade ports that had like you could set the number of credits that you could play, right? Sometimes you did that stuff because you wanted to beat the games, but sometimes it's like fun to turn on the moon jump in every single game and just play through the game with the moon jump. And maybe you couldn't beat the game without the moon jump, but like either way, it's still fun to moon jump around. So like adding those like hundreds, I mean, like if we really cared about the difficulty being perfect, we would, or like being easy, we wouldn't add hundreds of them. There's like no reason to add hundreds of them.
Right. Yes.
like what we cared about is like, it's like fun to have like this, like 100 things you could like mess with and make the game weird. And, you know, it's fun to see what the enemies are like when they're 4 times the size.
Yeah, when you think of like 007, GoldenEye had big head mode. Everybody talks about that as like a fun, dumb thing to do, because it is. It's just like it's a fun way to interact with a game that was like relatively easy for them to implement, and then makes like, I guess it's easy, but that's like not why I did it as a kid. I did it because I got to see like giant weird stretch, you know, textures across 3 polygons, and I got to shoot them real fun.
I guess, but in terms of other games, though, I mean, I think it's like, it's cool that games do whatever they think is cool for their game, right? I mean, we're not like people going like, you gotta put an easy mode in your game, or you gotta have cheats or way to like make your game accessible. Like, I mean, I think it's fun to have a game that does not have anything in it and be forced to do it. And I think it's fun when the game is like, lets you just make it super easy. And that's like part of the experience is like knowing I can switch between them at any time. And I think it's fun to have something like ours that's like, I guess it makes it easier, but it's also just like there's a crap ton of weird things you can do.
The weird ones are really fun. I wish those got more attention than the easier hard modifiers.
Tell me your top weird ones. Let's go. I want to hear what the ones you want to see more people using.
I really like the palettes. I'd spend a lot of time on those. Everybody should play with all the palettes.
Like there's like modes where you can switch it. So like when you jump, it changes the whole palette of the game.
Like full screen.
Full screen.
It's pretty dumb.
Yeah, there's I don't know, there's so many weird ones, it's hard to say.
Alec pointed out the floor is lava one, that's like you
floor lava is really fun.
It leaves behind a trail of damage.
Yeah, there's things that change what the text looks like. Yeah, that's really crazy. I'm like trying to think of what's, sorry, I like don't have like a good grapple on like there's stuff that unlocks once you beat the game. Like there's like hundreds that are available when you start the game, but there's also hundreds more that unlock when you beat the game. And I don't have like a good handle of what's like a spoiling.
You don't want to spoil any?
Yeah, I mean one of the best ones, which we've talked about already, is that there's an item shuffler in the game. So all, you know, everything you collect essentially, which is any item, any trinket or weapon or whatever, basically can be shuffled like random, like a randomizer. And so playing it in a way where you're collecting those things out of order is just like, it's very fun. It's shocking how much fun it is to play it that way. Like to the point where I like almost wish it was the default experience, because it's like so, it's so interesting how much it like actually works every time to play it with it randomized. And it just makes you realize, oh, all these, when you play it the first time, you probably will come away thinking like, this trinket's really good. You know, I have like a set of like 7 things that I think are awesome. And when you play with that randomizer, you're like, oh, you get different things in different orders. So you just immediately will equip them and you'll be like, oh, these are amazing. Also, I had no idea.
And they like work together in unique ways. Like the plasma funnel is really good when paired with the jug. One, I forgot what it's called. It's happened this morning.
Plasma jug.
Plasma jug, thank you. And you might not realize that unless it's like thrown at your face, like with the randomizer.
Yeah, there's a tendency to not change things once you get it and never use a potion or whatever when you go through. You're just like, I got to keep them. Maybe I'll need them later.
Yes, well, you find something you like and you're like, this works. I don't need to swap it out.
Stay where I'm at. Was I'm keen to see what the biggest challenge for you was in making this game. Like, what is the hardest thing that
So I think one of the hardest things for like doing the art for this game was like kind of comprehending this style, because I think like, you know, well, for one, like I was working on a separate game for the first half of development, basically. And then we kind of collapsed the team to really focus on Mina. And so like I kind of came in and there was an established style already kind of flowing. And I had to like really grasp that and try to be as agile as I could. And doing things the Game Boy Color way, like has really weird ramifications, you know, and making things look way more simple than you think. Even in Shovel Knight, I I just did whatever I did because that was like I was alone for the first 4 years of it, and so it was pretty easy to reel myself back, and I had Sean was helping me with that too. But with this, it was just like, okay, this is how like walking works, and it's a 16 pixel sprite, and like walking is just like shifting these 3 pixels around, and like it can't get too crazy because then it's like impossible to look at. Or one of the early things I did was the opening intro boss, then the Nether Kraken, and like, hey, we don't do water this way. And like my brain was like, okay, yeah, water is like very different. Like, so that's why like the tentacles that come out, they have like a little tiny like ring that does this, and that's the ripple, you know. Whereas when I first started, I was like, I was doing this like a 4-frame like cycling ripple. And it's like, no, that's not okay. You know, Sandy was like helping me a lot with that. And then just like, yeah, so adopting to that style and then trying to figure out ways to like expand it or like, you know, kind of find my own expression in that was definitely the most difficult part for me.
What about you, David?
For me, it was balancing the game. I mean, I've like programmed a million 2D games, so that's like nothing hard there. But the design of this game, where you could go to any level, it's an RPG, so you're leveling up. We only have like your max cap is 10 levels, so there's like not a lot of like, you know, it's not like we have like from 0 to 50 to play with, and there's 60 trinkets, and there's 5 weapons, and there's 15 sub weapons. Like all these things you can do them in any order. You can play, and we're not adjusting the difficulty of any area based on how you like what your character's at. So like we're making a very ambitious, like, you can screw yourself really easily and you can overpower yourself really easily depending on where you go or what you have. Or
yeah, I'm thinking of like people who have played it who did that exactly, right? Like there's friends who'd like jumped into level 3 at level 1, and we have other friend who like went to like he leveled up to 10.
Yes, yeah, so it's like, yeah, right. I'm going to play the game and get to like, I always go to max level right away. That's just like how I play my games. I'm going to buy everything in the shops, even like I'm going to farm until I buy everything that I can find. And then I will start playing the game. It's like, oh my God, what do we do? Like, why? We can't. Yeah. So why would you ever play that way? But that's like, that's how ambitious the game is. Right. And we just do nothing. We do basically nothing to like guard against it. So it's like, how are we pinning those stats? Where are we putting those items, like, to make sense that you might be balanced? Like, so, and on the contrary too, like, it's fun. It's fun in us, like in Dark Souls, to go and find that really powerful sword, like before you're supposed to have it, right? And we wanted that, those same kind of feelings too. And Mina, so like, just how do we balance that, like, that you want to be you if you know the game you can break the game, if you get tips from someone you can break it, and if you on the contrary like are terrible at the game you can still get by, and balancing all that stuff was just like very crazy. I think this was balanced like really unlike other games where we wanted to keep it much like Shovel Knight, where like this guy is 3 hits, this guy is 4 hits. So we didn't want like a wild, like it's just not fun. If you can kill this guy in 1 hit or this guy takes 8 hits to kill, it's not fun anymore, because that's just like the style of gameplay of those individual like designed enemies. Because it's very classic in that way. Like when you play a Castlevania game, if it takes 8 hits to kill a Medusa head, you will like blow your brains out. It's like that, it's like not okay for that to happen. So that like juggling all that stuff was just a real challenge.
Yeah, and also like when you level up your attack, you should see a level up.
You gotta feel it. You gotta feel right. That.
Like Gooper is 2 hits when you have level 1, and then he's like 1 hit when you're at level 2. But like that's like the underpinnings for how that works is like really complicated. And so like you can't just have like number stats go up. You care about like David's talking about, like the actual numbers of times it takes you to swing to hit and kill something. Yeah, there was a lot yeah, of tuning.
I looked at a lot more graphs than I'm used to looking at, I would say.
Yeah, I programmed a lot more graphs into the tools too.
Yes.
Look, I just want to leave you with one final question. And you know, this is one thing we always like to ask everyone who comes on the show. What is the biggest misconception about your work?
I mean, I think that people think this is a Zelda game, and they're like we were saying before, they're going to go in and they're going to think, I can't go in this water area because I don't have the flippers yet. And they're going to be a mistake.
there's no key items.
There are no key. Like, you can go anywhere from the beginning of the game and you don't need any items or anything to do that. I think that's going to be the biggest thing that is like just confuses people. And I mean, I think that is the most fun and exciting thing about the game. It's like not a Zelda. It's like got some of the, it gives you some of the same feelings and emotions. Like, you're going to get items and be able to cross a gap that you couldn't cross before. And that will be like fun. It like the navigation and like routing of the game is going to be really interesting, because in the same ways that it is interesting in Zelda, but you just don't need those things to get by. And you don't need the bombs to defeat the boss, right? I think that will confuse people for sure, but I think that's like the fun thing they'll discover.
I think, yeah, that's I'm on the same board there, because it's just you have to like kind of when you're having conversations about the game, kind of have to guide it away from it's a Zelda. It's you know, look for the key items. It's like, and also just in general, it's more actiony and more active and less defensive. And
right,
and
there's no Sokoban pushing block puzzles.
No, yes, also the yes, no puzzles.
That was like a rule from the beginning of the development. It was like no blocks will be pushed in this game.
no blocks, no Sokoban, no inventory, no like key items. Yeah.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. David D'Angelo, Nick Wozniak, thank you so much for being part of Lightmap. Good luck with the launch, and thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Hi, Kyle Paletto here from Drop Rate, Sifter's video game review podcast. Tomodachi Life returns with Living the Dream, a life sim with endless possibilities, like making Chapel Roan date the Loch Ness Monster.
So the concept of the game is that you've got an island of Miis, like the little Nintendo avatars. You're supposed to teach them about the people that you've based them off of. So then you get all of these really fun moments when they actually do the things that these people would or wouldn't do. Sabrina Carpenter fell in love with Mothman. Chapel Roan is in love with the Loch Ness Monster.
Checks out.
Gianni's in love with Sailor Moon.
That really checks out, actually. Find out more on Drop Rate, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
To Lightmap, interesting conversations with video game creators.
The Hollower launches on computer, Xbox, PlayStation, Switch 1 and 2 on the 29th of May. You can pick it up pretty much everywhere, as almost as soon as you can hear this episode. So this has been Lightmap Sifter's interview podcast. Today we're talking about Mina the Hollower from Yacht Club Games. Make sure you dig back into the Lightmap archives. We've got lots of great conversations for you to enjoy. Want to learn a bit more about how Fallout New Vegas was made? Well, we're going to do an episode with Josh Sawyer when he was down in Australia making video game films. Maybe you want to hear that episode we did with Alana Pierce or the legacy of some of those indie darlings, those retro games as well. Why not check out our episode about Celeste with Maddie Thorson and Noel Berry from Extremely OK Games. Search for Lightmap and Sifter on all your favorite podcast players and on YouTube as well. While you're there, check out our weekly games news show, which is called Walkthrough, and Drop Rate, which is our reviews podcast. Sifter is produced by Naomi Jackson, Fiona Bartholomeus, Kyle Paletto, Chris Button, and Adam Christou. Kat Jahn and Mitch Lowe are our senior producers, and my name is Gianni DiGiovanni. I'm Sifter's executive producer and the host of this episode. Thanks to Mina Shamali, who composed the Lightmap theme. Thanks to Audio Technica Australia and Apple for their support of Sifter. We'll catch you on the next episode of Lightmap. Until next time, have fun.